Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, Judge Merrick Garland's strange trip to Capitol Hill today, and speak with Elizabeth Wydra, the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. She joins us to discuss whether simple courtesy was on display today and if Republican senators were able to bring themselves to shake the nominee's hand in spite of the dictate from the Senate's Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, who on day one vowed to destroy Obama's presidency and vowed to block a replacement for Justice Scalia within an hour of the announcement of Scalia's death. Then we will speak with John Judas, a senior writer at the National Journal, who has a recent article at the Washington Post, "After 2016, Will Political Parties Ever Look the Same?" He joins us to discuss his forthcoming book, The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. We'll examine the rise of populism on the right and left in Europe and the United States and assess whether Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders will be the main beneficiaries of populist anger at those who have rigged the economy and downsized the American dream. Then finally, we'll explore the electoral landscape ahead in terms of who is motivated and who is alienated, and speak with Catherine Newman, who is the provost at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, and joins us to discuss how much the enthusiasm deficit on the Democratic side will depress the vote while Trump is activating independents and so-called Reagan Democrats on the Republican side. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's great to be with you. I am now president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. I've gotten a promotion.
We'll definitely promote you from now on.
Okay.
So in terms of Judge Merrick Garland's strange trip on Capitol Hill today, I know he met with Senator Leahy. Apparently he had phone conversations, though, with Mitch McConnell and with the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, and also with Senator Jim Imhoff. So what's your sense of, I thought that a part of the president's tactic was to sort of shame the Republicans into at least having to display a minimal level of simple courtesy.
Yes, absolutely. And the president said, all I'm asking is for you to be fair. And I think that's a really powerful statement, because when you see a nominee like Chief Judge Merrick Garland, who is so unimpeachably qualified, who has given decades to public service, who has served with distinction on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, who has been praised by Republicans right and left. He has been said, it was said by Orrin Hatch that he would be a consensus nominee choice for the Supreme Court. It's very hard to say that you're being fair if you refuse to even meet with this nominee, who unquestionably deserves fair consideration. I think it goes far beyond a meeting, but I think right now what you're seeing is a lot of these senators getting pressure to back off their position of not even meeting with him, because it's just so outrageous, and it completely violates the American people's sense of what is fair in this situation, and also goes against what has been happening in modern precedent. In the last few decades, even when there has been hotly debated Supreme Court nominees, the process has gone forward in terms of giving consideration. People can disagree with the nominee, but that's not what we're hearing right now. We're hearing just an opposition to the president's ability to nominate anyone. And that I think does not at all comport with what the American people think should be happening in this circumstance.
Well, I thought President Obama actually really did sort of completely devastated the kind of pillar of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans' argument, which is that the American people should decide this important choice on the Supreme Court, and we just have to wait for them to decide this election in order to make that decision. Obama, in an interview on NPR with Nina Totenberg, said today, just basically eviscerated that whole argument by saying, wait a minute, I was elected. The American people decided to make me president. I have a four-year term. They didn't decide that I only get 3 years and that the last year doesn't count. And Mitch McConnell was elected for 6 years, and the voters of Kentucky didn't decide that Mitch McConnell was only going to be good for 4 or 5 years, and the last 2 years of his terms didn't count. I mean, it is an absurd argument that the Republicans are putting forth.
And, you know, it's also, you know, when does that start? It's such an incredibly slippery slope. Are you going to start saying now that the president in the last 2 years in office? Is it 1 year? Is it 2 years? You know, how are they drawing the line? But I think an easy way, as the president has said, the president is the president up until the very last day of the term. The American people voted for him twice and put him into office, and he is the president up until the last day of his term. And the Constitution is clear that he has the right to nominate someone to the Supreme Court. There's no exception in that for election years or no time period of when he loses the right to nominate someone when there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court. He has the right to nominate someone to the Supreme Court. And he now has done his job under the Constitution. And what he has asked very forcefully for, and what the American people polls show want, is for the Senate to do its job and give that nominee fair consideration. And especially when you have a nominee like this, who has been praised by people across the ideological spectrum, who is so incredibly well-respected, to not even give that person the courtesy of a meeting, a hearing, and then an up or down vote, really, I think, will be problematic for the senators who are engaging in that kind of obstruction.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's a president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Have you argued before Judge Merrick Garland?
I have, actually. You know, my very first argument as a lawyer was in front of Judge Garland in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal, and I won. So, you know, he's good in my book on that score.
So then how do you explain then how Judge Merrick Garland is personally handling this? This is a very difficult thing. I mean, to be nominated, to have that Rose Garden ceremony with your wife, and then have to go through this particular peculiar kind of political tug-of-war, wander around Capitol Hill where all the doors are closed on you and, you know, the Republican senators are hiding under their desks. The whole thing is a little surreal. He did have phone calls with the Republicans, many of whom are blocking him. But in general, does he know something that we don't know? I mean, nobody wants to be a sacrificial lamb, surely.
No, and the president has made very clear that he fully intends to keep the pressure on. And I think supporters of the president and also just the American people, I think, will keep the pressure on these senators to do their job. So I don't think the president is viewing Judge Garland as a sacrificial lamb. I think he chose a nominee who is someone that Republicans themselves have previously said would be a good nominee. You know, it isn't as if he went and picked the most liberal possible nominee. He didn't. He went with someone who Republicans themselves have suggested repeatedly over the years as someone who should be on his list if a vacancy arose. And so I think he's taken a very straightforward approach to saying, I'm putting up a nominee that you have said you would accept, and he is unimpeachably qualified. He has been on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which a lot of people call the second highest court in the land because it's an incredibly important federal court of appeals. And now he's just asking them to give fair consideration to that nominee. And I think if the Senate does follow through with what has been their practice, you know, we've had people confirmed in election years. If they go through with that process, and this is a nominee that really deserves that, and I don't think he thinks it's a sacrificial lamb, and I don't think, frankly, Judge Garland thinks that. I was there in the Rose Garden when the announcement was made, and he was very emotional about it. It was a very moving moment. You know, he choked up and clearly is honored by this nomination. And I don't think he is looking at it as just, you know, a bit of theater. I think everyone is going through the process as it is intended to go, where the president seriously considers this, gives great deliberation to who is the best nominee, and he chose Merrick Garland, and he chose someone in this political moment who he thinks can actually get confirmed.
So then it must, if it's going to be continued on and that the White House is going to continue the pressure, and this is, they're trying to make this an election year issue, how much does it resonate, the court? I think it, my understanding is that on the political left, people care less about the court than on the political right. But on the other hand, you know, you have issues like abortion, which is one of the cases before the Supreme Court now, the Texas case, which could have huge consequences. So I'm not sure about whether Democrats care more than Republicans or vice versa. But it does seem that that's a big part of it. And how do you make an argument, for example, how ridiculous it is to have a Supreme Court that is no longer supreme, because many of the decisions, if they're a tied vote, get kicked back to the lower court. So the very nature of a Supreme Court is undercut by that fact that there's a missing seat.
Absolutely. And I think if ever there were a year in which the importance of the Supreme Court is clear to the American people, this is it, because you have pretty much every big issue that progressives in particular care about before the court. As you said, there's an abortion case. There's an important immigration case about the president's executive action to defer removal for parents of American citizens and lawful permanent residents. There's a case about public unions. There are voting rights cases, affirmative action, contraception, and the Affordable Care Act. The list goes on, and it's an incredibly important term. And you're absolutely right that what these Senate Republicans who are engaged in this obstruction, what that really means is not just hamstringing the court for this term, but because of the way the Supreme Court works, where they hear arguments basically from October to April, if you wait for the next president to be able to put forth a nominee, given historical practice of how long it takes, you're probably not going to get that person on the bench in the Supreme Court up there to actually hear cases until April 2017. That means for two entire Supreme Court terms, you're going to have a Supreme Court that cannot function the way that it is supposed to function, that it cannot set law in some cases for the entire country. So you might end up in a situation where you have people being able to exercise their fundamental rights in different ways based on which circuit, which state they live in the country, because the Supreme Court is going to be hamstrung in its ability when it splits 4-4 to set nationwide precedent. And not just for a month or so. You know, would it be the end of the world if there were an 8-justice court for, you know, 2 weeks or something? No, it wouldn't. They could set cases for re-argument. That's what they do often when they have a case like that. But you're talking about setting re-argument for a substantial number of important cases until 2 terms from now, 2 years from now, deep into 2017. That is unprecedented and, I think, irresponsible.
Well, you've made a very, very, I think, a very cogent argument that should resonate. Do you think that a Bernie Sanders or a Hillary Clinton could take up this argument? I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable argument, and it's pretty alarming that, you know, it's almost 2 terms without a proper court. That's unacceptable.
It's absolutely unacceptable. And I think it's really, you know, people have reacted very strongly against attempts by Republicans in Congress to shut down that branch of government. And now what you're seeing with this is their attempt to transmit that virus of dysfunction from the Congress to the Supreme Court. And that really is something that I don't think the American people will like. And so absolutely it should be elevated as much as possible, you know, even to the presidential candidate level, because, you know, the Supreme Court has the highest approval ratings of any of the branches of government. And I think that's partly because they don't have that gridlock that the political branches do. But now you have the political obstruction in the Senate hamstringing and putting gridlock into the Supreme Court for 2 terms. And, you know, when you think about the cases that are likely to split 4-4, when you only have an 8-justice court and thus the court being unable to establish nationwide precedent, that's not every case, to be sure, but they're generally the most important cases, cases involving fundamental rights, civil liberties, important questions of law on which the lower courts have disagreed, and that's why the cases, you know, are up at the Supreme Court in the first place. So this is really important, and attempts to downplay it, you know, really fall flat because you're talking about such an extended period of time and the most important cases. You know, people always joke that there aren't any easy cases in the Supreme Court because if they were easy, they wouldn't be at the Supreme Court. And so that's what we're talking about here, and it's really important.
Well, but lots of Republicans have said that it's no big problem, and I think they've quoted Justice Alito, haven't they, on that?
Yeah, and again, can the Supreme Court, on a very limited basis, operate without its full complement of nine justices? Sure. You know, sometimes justices are recused. You know, if there were a vacancy where you had an eight-justice court for, you know, a month, even 2 months, would that be the end of the world? Probably not, because you know, we've seen cases, for example, when some of Obama's recent appointees came on the bench, the court set a case for re-argument. But that's a matter of a month or so within the same term. We have never had a vacancy that extended this long while the court was active. Because let's just play this out. Okay, you have this important public union case that's being before the court, the Friedrichs case, a California public unions case. So if the court cannot have a five-justice majority, if it splits 4-4, what they might do is set the case for re-argument. But if we don't have someone on the bench until deep into 2017, you're going to have the public unions, an important part of American life, be in limbo for that length of time. That's not working properly. I don't know anyone who would say that that's the way that the Supreme Court should function and that's how our federal judiciary should function.
Well, Elizabeth Wydra, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Ian. Great to be with you.
Thank you again. And I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the populist explosion. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Judas, who's a senior writer at the National Journal and a former senior editor at the New Republic, an active member of SDS and the Left of the 60s. He taught philosophy at Berkeley and at San Francisco Art Institute. His latest book is Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century, and he has a recent article at the Washington Post, After 2016, Will Political Parties Ever Look the Same? And his forthcoming book is The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Judas.
Yeah, hi.
And I know that you were recently in Europe working on the book, looking at the rise of populism in Europe. And curiously enough, in 1935, during the rise of fascism in Europe, the novelist Sinclair Lewis wrote the semi-satirical novel It Can't Happen Here, which is about a U.S. senator named Buzz Winthrop, who's elected president, demanding that America returned to patriotism and traditional values, and he promises dramatic economic and social reforms and stumps on the platform that America needs a strong man to make the country great again. Any similarities there with Donald Trump?
Oh, you're talking about a fictional character. I think the greatest similarity I could find to Trump is probably Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, who was, fabulously wealthy guy. His rhetoric is very similar to Trump. I'm great, Look at how rich I am. I'm a very success in life. I'm going to do the same for Italy. Even more sexual escapades than Trump. So flamboyant. He was more of a party guy than Trump. I mean, I don't mean political party. He did organize his own political party named after a soccer slogan. But I think that he's the most, to date, I'd say he's the person who most resembles Trump, not Hitler or Mussolini or one of these other characters.
So I take it in your new book, then, you're making the distinction between American fascism, not that we've ever really had any manifestation of it, or at least nothing except perhaps Sinclair Lewis's book, and a few movies, but I guess the difference is we're talking about right-wing populism here in the United States, and I guess maybe we are talking about fascism in Europe in some respects with Jobbik in Hungary, but is that the definition? Clearly the F word gets thrown around a lot.
Oh, for the last 50, 60 years it's been thrown around a lot. Remember the Black Panthers had a united front against fascism in the in 1969 and 70 against Nixon, and a lot of people used to talk about him as a fascist. I don't think the comparison is helpful at this point. Maybe if Trump gets into office, he'll surprise us, and it will be appropriate. But Mussolini and Hitler both came out of political movements. They were organizers in a sense that to Trump is absolutely not. There was the whole corporatist element bringing, smashing labor unions, and there are a lot of differences between Trump and American politics and what was going on in Italy and Germany in the 1920s and the 1930s.
But what does appear to be going on today, both in Europe and in the United States, is that traditional parties are breaking down. The Democrats and the Republicans, after all, up until very recently, the leading candidate on the Democratic presidential side was Bernie Sanders, who's a self-declared socialist and the longest-serving independent in American political history. And on the Republican side, it's very hard to say that Donald Trump is a traditional Republican. And, of course, in Europe, you've got UKIP evolving and spinning off from the conservatives on the right as Le Pen's party gains in France. And it does look like the traditional divide in Europe between conservatives and socialists is also breaking down. So what would explain that?
Well, here, let me say first that I think in the United States we're not, the Democrats and the Republicans are not about to spawn a third party. It's not going to be like 1856 when you had a third party. I doubt that very much, but the coalitions that have sustained those parties are in trouble, particularly the Republicans, particularly the coalition between business on the one hand and downscale white voters. I think I think Trump has really driven a wedge into that coalition. Europe, you really do have party breakdown. I mean, in Greece, Syriza has virtually destroyed the Panhellenic Socialist Party, which was ruled Greece for, I don't know, what is it, 10 of 16 years between 1995 and 2011, and now it got something like 4% in the polls. Spain, Podemos, is now like 1% behind the socialists. Le Pen and the Front National in France are taking a lot of votes from the old communists and the socialists. So in those countries, I could mention more: Denmark, Holland, Sweden, Finland, Norway, all those places. The dominance of two leading parties, a Labour or Social Democratic Party on the one hand, and a Christian Democratic or what have you, a Tory conservative party, and the other is breaking down, and they have like now a three parties and four parties. I mean, Italy is just completely blown apart. So there really is a destruction of the party system in a way that in the United States we're just seeing like the first tremors. And I think a lot of it has to do with the reaction to austerity. In Europe, it's a reaction to the European Union, the EU, and also to the refugees and immigration. So that's, I think those are the factors. United States, it's like 40 years of deregulation, growing inequality, things like that. I mean, immigration, again, is partly a cultural issue, but in some states, it's an economic issue too, where you get illegal immigrants or legal immigrants are people are seen as burdening the welfare system, taking jobs in construction, things like that. So there's similar kinds of issues affecting both Europe and the United States, and the parties which at the very top have been very similar. And we're talking about the business in both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, are finding their axioms, their principles challenged: financial deregulation, tax breaks going primarily upwards, all that stuff. So,
well, again, I'm speaking with John Judas. He's a senior writer at the National Journal and a former senior editor at the New Republic. He has a recent article at the Washington Post, After 2016, Will Political Parties Ever Look the Same? And his forthcoming book is The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. So I think that's an inescapable fact, isn't it, that there's still a lot of pain and residual destruction, if you will, from the Great Recession here in the United States. It's very much been Bernie Sanders' centerpiece, pointing out how Wall Street basically took the global economy to the brink, and then the taxpayer had to bail them out, and now they're even too bigger to fail. And while Wall Street flourishes, Main Street languishes. And Trump is also tapping into, paradoxically, into a kind of anti-Wall Street sentiment, even though he keeps talking about his friend Carl Icahn, who I can imagine he'll make Secretary of the Treasury. So give us a sense of your conclusions about how much the Great Recession still lingers and how much it's affected our politics since 2008.
Well, let's talk about the United States. I mean, I think, you know, the Trump and Sanders constituencies really are different. I know that you can always, I found people who were can't decide which guy to vote for, but in general, I think they're really different. But they're both constituencies that have, in the last 10 years and maybe in the last 20 and 30, really felt the bite of the economy. Sanders among the young. You know, it's hard to make this generalization, but I think that his success shows that there is a tremendous amount of anxiety, fear of the future among young voters. Graduating for college is no longer a ticket to a good job. These kids are graduating with a lot of debt and without the best kinds of prospects. More and more are living with their families, something that I'm familiar with personally. So I think that that's a constituency that was particularly hit in the last, let's say, 15 years when the debt piled up and feel great resentment over what happened and that sufficient steps weren't taken to do something about Wall Street and about the kind of malfeasance that was done that created these enormous debt crises. So that's one thing. Trump, more, again, downscale whites, closing of factories, the effect of runaway shops. He talks a lot about companies moving overseas. He talks a lot about what the trade with China has done to American manufacturing. And I think that's a constituency, even if, let's say, all those voters didn't have factory jobs, their relatives might have, their husbands or wives might have. He's getting a lot of those people, and he's appealing to that kind of anxiety. And it's different. They're two different groups, but they're both groups that really have been affected by the kind of economic policies we've had over the last 20, 30, 40 years. Financial deregulation on the one hand and various trade deals that encourage corporations to go overseas.
So who do you think then, of those, obviously Trump is still on a roll, even though now more and more the Republicans are talking about a brokered convention, that nobody's going to come into the convention with a sufficient number of delegates to clinch the nomination outright, that there'll be some kind of brokered convention. Many think it, predict it will be almost as raucous, if not as bloody, as the 1968 Democratic Convention was in Chicago. And Bernie Sanders now has a more difficult path to the nomination, as Hillary Clinton seems to get more and more delegates. How do you think Hillary Clinton's going to be able to tap into the very anger that Bernie Sanders is tapping into and to keep those young voters, potential voters, in the tent and motivated?
Well, I was worried, if you'd asked me a year ago about whether Hillary Clinton could win against a Republican. But at that time, I thought, you know, it'd be Jeb Bush or somebody in the middle, and that they'd be able to put together a Florida, Ohio kind of ticket against her. Her biggest asset will be Trump if he's the opponent. And if they're any good, they'll make the election about him and not about her and about the threat that he poses to minorities, to women, and so on. So I think in that setting, she'll be fine, and she won't have to bring out a vote that she might otherwise have difficulty doing. I'm not a big fan of Hillary Clinton as a campaigner, nor it seems of her political operation, which hasn't been great, but her forte is debates, and she does best when when people are being nasty to her, and you could see what she did at those Benghazi hearings, and I would assume that she'd do pretty well against Donald Trump in the fall. So, you know, the question there will be whether the debate's about her or whether the election's about her foibles or his foibles. And if they're about him, I think that she has a really good chance to win, regardless of whether she can fire up the vote about among all these constituencies. He'll do it for her.
But he'll probably tack to the center, if not to the left, and may even campaign to the left of her on foreign policy. Do you think that would make a difference?
Not on foreign policy, but on I think on some economic issues like trade, he will try to campaign to her left. But he's stuck himself with a lot of statements that he's going to have a hard time living down. If you look at the 2012 election, Romney really got hurt in January and February or so of 2012, when Gingrich and people like that were running all these ads against him as being, laying off workers and all this stuff. And then the Obama people were just able to continue that. I think that he has a lot of baggage, and that they will be able to exploit that.
So what's your sense then of why we have, appear to have, a surge in right-wing populism in the way that Trump is bringing out new voters? Many of them are independents, some are the what used to be called Reagan Democrats. Why is that apparently a more powerful and lasting manifestation than perhaps the people that Bernie Sanders has brought out, even though we don't know whether Hillary's going to be able to win them over if it comes to that?
Well, again, I think that what Bernie Sanders is bringing out, the constituents, the groups, could be a lot larger in the future, and another candidate might be able to do a better or more plausible job of doing that. So I wouldn't so much compare those. But the Trump constituency is an old constituency in American politics. It goes back to the 60s and to the white Democrats who left the party over civil rights. Then there's been this succession of defections from the Democratic Party, particularly in the South, but also in the North and among white working class, now some college-educated voters, that he's appealing to. And these are people that, to some extent, feel left behind by post-industrial capitalism and feel that the Democrats are a party that primarily is concerned about minorities and not about themselves. And that's been the basis, a lot of the basis of Trump's appeal.
So will it come down then to the endangered white men versus the insulted minorities?
But add suburban women.
Well,
who might otherwise vote the Republican.
Right.
And you've got it.
Right.
And especially if there's a lot of Republicans, the way there was during the Goldwater race, where there were a lot of Republican politicians who wouldn't endorse the candidate. I think the Republicans are in trouble. I mean, I could see a way that Trump could win, but they're in trouble with him, and they're in a lot of trouble if they denied him the nomination. Like you said, it could be like 1968, where a lot of people didn't vote for Humphrey because they thought he was an illegitimate candidate.
Well, just in closing, John Judas, in terms of your forthcoming book, The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed America and American and European Politics, how long is this explosion going to resonate? Is this just a 2016 explosion, or is it going to echo through the ages?
I don't know. Europe is ahead of us, and I think that in those respects, and they've got real problems with the euro and the EU and the refugees, the blowback from various interventions in Iraq, Syria, and Libya that are going to be hard to deal with. That stuff is going to continue. As far as the United States is concerned, I'm just not sure. I think we're in a much, much earlier stage. My expectation is that something like what's been going on for the last 10 years of the two parties exchanging roles, one winning the presidency and the other the Congress and state houses, is going to continue for a while.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, John Judas.
Sure. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with John Judas, who's a senior writer at the National Journal and a former senior editor at The New Republic. He has a recent article at The Washington Post, After 2016, Will Political Parties Ever Look the Same? And his forthcoming book is The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back exploring the electoral landscape ahead in terms of who is motivated and who is alienated. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Catherine Newman, who's the provost at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, including The Accordion Family and The Missing Class. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Newman.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be with you.
And I'd like to explore the electoral landscape ahead, if we could, in terms of who is motivated and who is alienated. And it does seem to be that Donald Trump is motivating voters on the right. And my sense is that if Bernie Sanders doesn't make it, which is increasingly likely that he won't, in terms of delegates, that there may be a lot of alienation on the left. What's your reading on the landscape ahead?
I actually think that Bernie Sanders has motivated an entire generation of voters, much the way Obama did in previous elections. Younger voters have seen the backhand of the economy through the Great Recession. And for them, the status quo is not a very happy place. And I think they see in Sanders a hero who speaks to their interests, with college debt looming over them, with jobs that are insecure. They are not large enough in number to pull off the kind of success that he was hoping for. But I do think they've been mobilized, and my guess is that if Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, that will be sufficiently frightening to them that they will turn out for Hillary Clinton.
But in your work, given that you've written 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, Catherine Newman, what is the explanation for why people, poor people who have really could benefit a lot from voting, don't vote, whereas rich people and middle class people do vote?
It has always been hard to mobilize the poor. Their lives tend to be very pressured. They are scrambling to make ends meet. They're often not well educated, and voting tends to follow along educational lines. So it's not all that surprising that we don't see heavy voter turnout among the poor. But I agree with you that it's unfortunate, because never has it been more important for their interests to be represented. And instead, they tend to be represented mostly by the young, who overlap with them to some degree. But it has always proven difficult to mobilize the very people who would have the most to gain if they did turn out. I've just been reading a book on the history of the civil rights movement, where a concerted effort was made to register poor people to vote, and it took an incredible mobilization to do that. And when it worked spectacularly, but it took a social movement focused on voter registration, which is not really what we have right now.
So is there an element in this, or at least a fault in this, in terms of what has happened to education in this country, that education, you know, they used to teach civics, for example, and in many ways education should prepare you for citizenship and citizen involvement. But the trend has been to, first of all, I don't think civics are taught anymore, and the trend has been more towards preparing you for a job as opposed to preparing you to be a good citizen.
I'm not sure, to be honest, whether civics education was ever responsible for voter turnout. It's more likely that educated people were more likely to become homeowners. When they had children, they have a vested interest in how their communities are managed. And those are the kinds of triggers that tend to lead to high levels of voter participation. As you know, Robert Putnam has written extensively about the great generations that came before and their level of citizen engagement. And he has lamented the phenomenon of bowling alone and the ways in which this has declined civic participation. I actually am somewhat more encouraged in that narrative, because the ways in which young people turned out first for Obama and then for Bernie Sanders really suggested to me that there is an audience out there, among young people anyway, for hungry for a better future, who do see the political sphere as an avenue to that. But they are often disappointed, and they will probably be disappointed this time too, in who their candidates are and in the ways in which they move to the center, because they're looking for a more transformative narrative, one that tends to reside more on the edges than in the center.
So what explains then the enthusiasm, do you think, on Donald Trump's side in terms of this right-wing populism, which, of course, you know, the F word has been thrown around a lot, and that's often done irresponsibly, and it doesn't appear to be that's what the phenomenon is so much as more like, I think, a repeat of George Wallace as opposed to Adolf Hitler.
Well, I think that this is impossible to understand without recognizing how devastating the Great Recession was in the U.S. It compounded secular changes that have been ongoing for quite some time that have really hammered the unskilled white working class. These are the people who once manned the factories and who had pretty good jobs without a lot of education, and they have really been destroyed economically. And the last blow was the Great Recession, which is still with us for these people. They really have not recovered, and they feel that sort of abandonment by the political class, which doesn't seem to care very much about how hard things have been for them. And I think that's the best explanation. They're looking for a kind of rescue vehicle that will somehow turn the clock back to the period before the mid-70s, when a strong back and a willingness to work would be enough, and it just isn't anymore. And I think that's been very, very hard for the white working class, and they're angry, and they feel abandoned by everyone else. Why they feel that Donald Trump is likely to rescue them is a bit of a mystery. His interests wouldn't seem to be particularly aligned, but I think just his expression of anger and his willingness to throw his weight around feels empowering to people who have really lost all standing, both in our polity, but even more profoundly in our economy. So they don't see any good alternatives. They certainly don't see the Republican standard bearers as in their corner. These are the people who have been on the side of Wall Street as they see it, and that's certainly not an interest that they share. So I think for them, this populist stick-it-in-your-eye kind of approach, it gives full throat to the anger they feel about having been left behind and abandoned by just about everybody. So, I have to add there as well that, you know, these people are not friends of a racial revolution. I think they, are simply not a liberal contingency whatsoever. So with them, you mix anger at displacement with a sense of racial resentment that has been exacerbated by Obama's period in the White House.
And is there an element here of Norman Vincent Peale and the prosperity gospel? The sense that I get is that Donald Trump is promising his voters that he'll make them all millionaires, and meanwhile he's a billionaire, and his billionaire buddy, Carl Icahn, he keeps referring to as the kind of guy we need in government. If anybody epitomized Wall Street, Carl Icahn does. So,
yes, well, I think again, Donald Trump represents this kind of, in his own way, this sort of sunny estimate that it won't be hard to get back to the prosperity of the past. And, of course, it will be hard. But he skips over those nuances with great agility. And I don't think the details are particularly important. In fact, I don't think the details of what he says matters at all to these listeners. They're not thinking about him as a policy wonk. I mean, he's not, and they don't hold him to consistency. I don't think they care really what he says so much as the way he says it. The way he says what he says conveys this kind of independence and strength and ability to tell other people off that I think a lot of other angry, displaced people wish they had, and they don't. So they see in him this kind of embodiment of strength in the way that I think people saw George Wallace. And, well, I think Hitler is too strong a metaphor in many ways. I do think many of the same cultural resonances are there, this idea that other people are to blame for your fault, for your problems. And if we just slam the door shut on the border, or we just throw people out of the room that we don't agree with, somehow this is going to solve things. And, of course, it never does.
But broadening out the conversation, Catherine Newman, it does seem in many ways what's at play here is a question of whether the U.S. is still a democracy and has become a plutocracy. And my sense is that all of the arguments that Bernie Sanders is making about inequality ultimately make the point that America today is a country that's doing well for the plutocrats. They've really made out, and he keeps referring to the 1% of the 1% and how wages are flat and people are working longer for less. So if that is indeed the picture, that this is a kind of plutocratic paradise, if you will, is there a possibility, do you think, a realistic possibility to restore the American dream, to create a social contract, you know, given that what little social contract we have is pretty frayed?
Well, I think that Bernie Sanders offers a vision of social democracy that sounds a lot more like the Scandinavian social welfare states. And for those who know what that means, it's a very positive vision. It's a vision in which government steps in to protect the little guy, in which we invest as a nation in the institutions that have fomented social mobility in the past, like free higher education. This sounds sort of almost absurd and unrealistic to many modern voters, but, you know, I had a free college education in the state of California. That's what higher education in California was until the 1970s. So there have been long periods of time in which the country, through the GI Bill, through various state formulas, made higher education free, and it was one of the best investments we ever made as a country. So these are not unrealistic ideas. They're just the opposite of the way we've been trending, where we've put more and more obligations on the private citizen and the family in the form of debt and less in the civic sphere as a common investment amongst all of us. So I don't think these are unrealistic aspirations because we lived through them for decades, and they were wise investments. But I don't, it doesn't appear to have carried the day in the states where the rich delegate pools lie. And so my guess is that probably we won't have Sanders as a candidate. We will have Clinton instead. And I think that enough people, young the people who were supporting Sanders, will be afraid of what would happen if Trump were elected, that they will come out and support the Democratic ticket. I'm actually reasonably optimistic about what this next election will mean for progressives, because I think there's a reasonable chance that the Senate will become a Democrat-rich institution, and there will be some Supreme Court vacancies that will be filled by a Democratic president, and that will be important for the future. So I'm reasonably optimistic about all of this, but it's still frightening, I think, to anyone who's a who's really thinking about what it would mean that we could have a major political party headed up by somebody like Donald Trump. I think it's an embarrassment to the nation.
Well, in terms of, though, how quickly we've transformed from a social democracy, which arguably existed from about 1947 to 1977, and how you just suggested that people don't see that as being attainable, even though it was in very recently that we had many of the benefits of social democracy, as you pointed out with your own education. So that, to me, is a puzzlement why either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton have not really made a clear enough case about what is possible, because in many ways, taxing is the DNA of a society, and all of the Republican candidates, including Donald Trump, all they want to do is make even further tax cuts for the wealthy. It's extraordinary that all of their programs are identical and equally ludicrous in the face of their constant complaints about the looming deficit, which they're only going to just add to. But on the other hand, you know, it wasn't that long ago when President Eisenhower was president, and the wealthiest in this country were paying 92% tax. So It's not as if you have to go back to 92%, but at least go back, you know, level the playing field a little.
Yes, well, I think we have a long way to go to convince citizens that those taxes will be spent for purposes that they endorse. When you see ballot initiatives in my original home state of California, though, you see what can be done. The citizens of California voted twice to make significant investments in education. One was to reduce the size of K-3 classes, and the other was to support the great public universities of that state. when told that's what the money would be for, there was quite extraordinary citizen support. So I think part of what we need to do is to explain to people what these tax dollars will be used for. And if they knew that they would be not sort of just general expenditures or just military expenditures, but expenditures that actually make a difference for the quality of their lives, you get a very different outcome. I mean, California has not been a tax-friendly state in general, but it was very friendly to these kinds of investments when they were specified. And so I think there's a lesson to be learned there about how to make it clear to people that certain kinds of taxes are investments in their own well-being that they and their children will benefit from. I mean, we've paid higher taxes for medical expenses, and when we know that that's what it's going to be used for, there's, you know, that becomes something of a third rail. You don't touch that as a politician unless you're crazy. Because these things are crucial, and they become part of the household economy, which is what I think the Affordable Care Act is going to become in not very long a time. It will become embedded in the household economy, and it will become a third rail of its own. I can't imagine, for example, seeing anybody roll back the provision of the Affordable Care Act that entitles families to keep their children on their health insurance until they're 26, or the provisions that make it illegal to disqualify people for pre-existing conditions. These have become essential parts of every household's economy. And once that happens, it's like Social Security. You can't touch it. So I think convincing people about paying taxes is not something that can be done in a general way. It has to be done with specific reference to what it is ordinary people can expect out of their government. And if they can be convinced that that will matter to them, that it will change their lives in positive ways, I do think we have some evidence that that can work.
Well, just in closing then, why are all of the Republicans running this jihad against the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare?
You know, I think they're doing it because they just absolutely abhor the idea of government involvement of any kind, but I don't think it's going to work. It's not going to work. I don't think the Affordable Care Act will ever be reversed. It is becoming too important to every household. And, you know, if you look back at the history of Social Security, the same party railed against the creation of Social Security. It was a socialist plot. It would destroy the work ethic. I mean, the long and vitriolic history of opposition to Social Security was enormous. And here we are today. It's an absolute fixture in our political world. So those jihads don't always work. And I don't think they're going to work in this case either.
Well, Catherine Newman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And I've been speaking with Catherine Newman, who is the provost at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's the author of 12 books on poverty, the working poor, and the consequences of inequality, including The Accordion Family and The Missing Class. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.